Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi, friends. I join you here in Chicago's suburbs.
Brian Brushwood.
I, too, am from Chicago's suburbs. The far, far southern outskirts of Chicago, a.k.a. Austin, Texas.
Gentlemen, it's great that you've established where you are. It's good to know your location. Once you have an idea of your location, you need to be aware of things around you, things you may not think could be potential threats or maybe a sneaking menace that could be around you before you even realize it.
You know what? You're this close to describing us having alibis. Are you about to accuse us of something?
In this two-parter, maybe in the second part.
Okay.
But in the first parter, listen.
We got parts.
I don't want to disparage any particular group. I don't think that's right. I don't think it's right to judge the larger group by the actions of an individual. But I became aware of something. I saw a YouTube video, and it is part of a disturbing trend.
Uh-oh.
A jeweler noticed that somebody outside a shop felt bad, decided to give them food, turned his back. Next thing you know, they take advantage of the kindness. They work their way into the door he opened, sat down at the cash register, grabbed a handful of cash, and ran off with it.
This sounds like a real rapscallion.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, can we get a hint as to what part of the world? I mean, this doesn't even seem like something that would happen in the United States.
Well, let me tell you what part of the world it is, and you're already going to know the identity and everything.
Okay, all right. Well, then let me hold off on that. Instead,
all right, let's just pretend we don't know that it's Boise.
And let me just say, another member of this group, which is not a political group or anything like that, as far as we know, may have been involved.
I mean, okay, you're saying some people like
blackout.
No, this is good that you're being sensitive, because some might think like the moment you say what group this being is a part of, we're just going to immediately just plaster all of our biases upon it.
Right, and I will say, just because the same week this member of a group was also implicated in a nationwide blackout.
Okay, maybe I don't know which group we're talking about after all.
And I'll be very clear. Like, let's say hypothetically we're talking about computer programmers. Not all computer programmers are hackers or bad hackers. Not all are good. You know, because somebody does something nefarious, Guccifer, doesn't mean that somebody who's, you know, maybe doing a thing where they're exposing the fact that when people are getting code repositories down, that you can actually use domain spoofing to infiltrate other computer systems. Some is good, some is bad, some is we don't know. So this group, we're not trying to disparage, but there were two events this week that
one was a theft, and the other was what was the other one?
National power outage.
Okay.
All right. So, Andrew, I'm going to ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
How many legs did they have? Also, none is a viable answer.
Two legs.
Bipedal, huh?
I mean, yeah.
Well,
I gotta feel like we've got an awful lot in common with whoever these beings are. Some may call us close cousins, if I'm thinking correctly.
Yeah, we're gonna jump to the chase here. India is the location of the first one. Conniving monkey steals 10,000 rupees from a jewelry store.
I love the fact that they ascribe motivation to the monkey. Like,
Bryce, would you pull that thing up? I want you guys to tell me if there is anything else that applies better than conniving.
All right, here we go. We're looking at a Daily Mail piece here. We're looking at the video.
Yeah, I don't know. All right, well, here. So there's this monkey sitting outside.
He gave some money.
The shop owner wants to try and feed him.
Gave him like an apple or
something?
Yeah,
gave him some food. Monkey eats the food and then scrambling at the door.
Oh, he pushes the
Pushes the door open.
He's in.
Blows right past the guy.
All right, so we pushed inside. Oh, my gosh.
Cut to another security camera. This thing is hopping around. Check it out. He looks like he's about to start taking orders.
He's sitting at the chair behind the counter in front of the computer and where they have the cash box.
So wait, I mean, does that ascribe motivation to it? Maybe this guy. Oh my God, that's
my
a lot of.
Lord.
Okay, first of all, no legitimate.
This is a cabinet that has a lot of money in it.
That's just a random ass drawer filled with wadded up bills, and he leaves with it in his mouth.
Oh, so by the way, the poor shopkeeper thinks he understands the motivation of the monkey and is like, oh, wait, here, do you want more food? And the monkey's like, sucker, look what I can buy with all this cash, son.
Oh, the awkward half-hearted chase of the monkey is the best part.
Cue the Benny Hill theme. And here's a guy who, like, he's trying to do nice. He's trying to do a nice thing. He's like, hey, little monkey, you want some food? He's like, I've done my good thing. I'm nice. I've helped him out. Turns his back. Next thing you know, the monkey is in his door reaching into the cash register. It's almost like the monkey was trained to do
that. So, okay, there was one moment.
Yeah.
I would love to know how much 10,000 rupees feels like to lose. Because if it's like a few ones, that's a funny
150
story.
$150.
That's substantial, man.
I'm going to punch that monkey if I'm the shopkeeper. I'm not here for any kind of cruelty to animals, but if somebody tries to jack me for $150, I'm going to punch that monkey.
So I bought a hard drive that I couldn't really afford. Let's flash back to 2007, early days of BBOTR, just about to start pitching Scam School. And I need more room to hold video footage and so on. So I get a hard drive from Fry's, and it has a rebate. And this is back when I was really good about rebates or whatever. And then I had a puppy named Pepper at the time. And Pepper definitely grabbed the receipt. That was definitely necessary. That was definitely worth $80 of the $300 I just spent. And started flailing, gallivanting around with this jaunty receipt out of his mouth, and then eventually just started eating it. And I tried to get it, and then in a panic to keep me from taking it, he swallowed the damn thing. And it was a great object lesson in how important stakes are in comedy, because I was very upset because $80 was a lot of money, but it made it all the funnier because there were really real stakes there.
Well, let's talk about some serious stakes here, okay? Now, we have an instance of a monkey who is a thief. Kenya's entire power grid. Now, this is an interesting article here because they kind of – there's the question and the obvious thing that should be stated but wasn't stated is in here. Kenya's entire power grid after a monkey falls onto the transformer at the electrical plant.
I mean, that's got to be kind of horrific, right? Just seeing this whole – flash, splash, and then there's a ball of white light, and then all of a sudden...
It says, a monkey has been blamed for causing a nationwide blackout in Kenya after falling onto a transfer power station. So they describe how apparently an ape climbed on the power transformer and tripped a transformer and dropped on the transformer, tripping it. And so then they say this caused other machines of the power station to trip on overload, resulting in a loss of more than 180 megawatts from this plant, which triggered a national power blackout. So... yeah, there's no detail in this article about the monkey itself.
I would imagine that thing's vaporized. I told you about the story that...
Oh, yes. You might try to vaporize that monkey, but you will only make it more powerful than you could ever imagine.
If by more powerful you mean grant it the power to knock out the power grid for a little bit.
Instant get back for the monkey. Oh, monkey's alive!
No.
What?
The animal appears to be a Vervin monkey survived the incident. Monkey is alive, according to Ken Jen's Facebook post, and taken in by the Kenyan Wildlife Service.
Oh, well, thank goodness that everybody's...
Although, by the way, listen, as if casting some aspersions... Nesh, can you go back to that? The Kenya Wildlife Service Nairobi headquarters was unable to confirm the status of the monkey to the Washington Post. Thanks for doing that little... extra piece of shoe leather, Washington Post.
Yeah.
I told you guys about the story that I heard, and this is all apocryphal.
In the Washington Post, where they've now become dedicated to monkey trutherness?
No. This was somebody who worked in, I guess, the Navy. It's a submarine, so that would be the Navy, right? And he was
where
there.
You can sail the seven seas.
Yeah. No, you could do just what you please, I'm told.
You can put your mind at ease.
Yeah. But this guy worked on a nuclear sub, and they had gotten into dock or whatever, and he happened to be standing very close to somebody who improperly was attaching one of those major power conduits to the sub, and you know, there's so much power flowing through it that it vaporized the guy's body in front of him. He said it was like the opening to Repo Man, if anyone saw that movie, where there was a flash of purple vapor, and then there were the remnants of his shoes, and that's all there was. He just vanished in a blast of red mist, basically.
That's horrifying, Brian.
I mean, but I'm just saying, that's why I assume, like, when it comes to power line stuff, but it's like, that was amazing.
Hey, listen, you want to call? All right, fine. Ken Jen, you're on notice. Brian says you're a liar, and he's teamed up with the Washington Post to figure out the truth.
Wait, what did Ken Jen say?
Ken Jen says the monkey's alive.
Yeah.
New York Times says that, too.
Oh, look at that. Now we're drawing battle lines. Who's on whose side? This is like Civil War.
Maybe it's time to do some original reporting. One of us needs to book a ticket.
Somebody get Kemi Kenjen's phone number. Hello? Kenjen, it's me, Justin.
Well, gentlemen, I have an idea of how we can get to the bottom of this. But first, we want to let you all know that we appreciate our sponsors out there. That's you, the Patreons, the people that make this show possible.
Yeah, patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support this show no matter what. Rain, sleet, hail, monkeys falling into Transformers and either living or dying, depending on what news source you trust.
Nothing will stop us. The suburbs of Chicago can keep us from getting you the weird things.
Nothing can stop us. Ain't no stopping us now, as long as you guys continue to support us as you have at patreon.com/weirdthings. We thank all of our supporters, and we very much hope to continue to provide you guys with the weird entertainment we believe you deserve.
I have an idea on how we get to the bottom of this, guys. You ready for this?
Yeah, I'm ready.
We get Bryce after he does his goblin investigation, and we send him to Kenya to find out, you know, maybe drop monkeys on Transformers, but to get him there. How are we going to get them there? That's what you're asking, Andrew. How do we get him there?
Yeah, no. Ours is largely a problem of conveyance. Upon what device shall we take him from point A to B?
I say you ask Larry Page. Larry Page of Google fame, the guy that came up with PageRank, one of the richest men in the world. Apparently, what does he do as a hobby? No, not just like sit around, you know, collecting, you know, movie figurines or, you know, playing Magic the Gathering or whatever. No, Larry Page has a very one of his sidelines is he's got two competing companies located very near each other. He said, you know what? Why buy one when I can buy two? Because I'm Larry Page, and every time you accidentally click on that mobile ad, I get money. I could hear a ka-ching sound. Larry Page has not one but two secret flying car companies.
All right, this is way better than my guess, because my guess was just pause on this, because before we go to flying cars, I had my sights set so much lower. I thought you were going to talk about the record-breaking flying hoverboard, the actual flying hoverboard flight that the guy did. This is so much cooler. I got nothing. I got nothing. What are these?
So Larry Page, apparently now this is the new thing. Larry founded one company, was apparently not thrilled with how fast they were going, so he founded a competitor.
Or funded, yeah.
Funded a competitor. One of them, though, was in his house that he had to clear out things like some SpaceX equipment that Elon Musk had given him so they could make their little they could make their office, for which he was referred to as Gus, or the guy upstairs.
Yes. Apparently had his crazy man cave upstairs. You know, man cave upstairs, flying car company downstairs. Really, I don't think you get much baller than that. I mean, when you're buddies with Elon Musk, you're looking for ways to try to keep up. Well, there is a – I looked up the patent, by the way. If you look up the patent on this, which is patent 9 2 4 2 7 3 8 You can see an example of one of their patents for this thing, and this is – it is horrifying. It looks like a flying abattoir.
That's a hell of a sales pitch, by the way.
Oh, you need to see this because there's some crazy illustrations that go along with this Bloomberg article, which detail the plans. But when you dig a little bit deeper into it, you see the patent for this thing, and it is let me see if I can pull up an image of this. This is like, I'm like, oh, let us see what this thing looks like. And I'm kind of like, I don't want to be negative, but I'm kind of like, nope. When you see
is it just that it doesn't feel sufficiently aerodynamic to you? You feel like there's no way you're going to get in this thing?
So a big question you have, if you want to build a flying car and you're using electrics, is you want to have an issue of redundancy. You want to make sure that if one system fails and it still works. If a helicopter, if the engine fails on a helicopter, that rotor can actually continuously, it'll slow you down as it spins and it falls down. So you can slow down your descent. So take a look at this thing here.
Okay. So
zoom in.
This looks like a I would not get in this thing. It definitely has 8 propellers. It looks like a crazy drone.
It looks like a fun little garden filled with spinning death blades.
Well, so I remember as far back as 20 years ago now. Checking out the Mahler Sky Car at Mahler, MOLLER.com. And I remember hearing that the big problem was that, you know, not that we couldn't make objects that are small, condensed, and have, rotors that fly, but the problem was that the noise ordinances, there was no way you could drive this anywhere that people would allow it to go. It would just be jet engine noise as far as anyone can hear. Do you think there's sound control aspects to this?
So I think that will be an issue, but that wasn't really the principal problem of the Mueller flying car was it didn't fly, is that, you know, he had been for 30 years raising money to build this thing, and the technology was just a little bit further beyond his grasp. And at the time of conception, they didn't have composites, and you didn't have, you know, what you can do with electrics can give you kind of an increased efficiency, et cetera. There are a lot of problems with that, but noise is a problem. Noise is certainly a problem. Have they solved that? That wasn't mentioned. And oddly enough, I had a conversation a couple days ago with a venture capitalist who had been looking into flying cars. And my suggestion was, our observation was, if you look at some of the research into drones and noise reduction, it starts to sort of, after like 6 or 7 years ago, there's not as much of that. Which looks almost like somebody or some agencies may be hiring people to develop much more quieter drones, which would imply that perhaps the Defense Department has probably invested a lot of money, and a lot of the researchers doing really interesting research into that are finding themselves in places where they're funded, but not in the civil sector.
That's interesting. So I remember
pure speculation on my part.
No. I certainly believe all of that. I'm curious, like, there was a brief moment, I would say about 10 years ago, that I was trying to figure out which I would want more, a flying car or a self-driving car. And now I think I'm pretty firmly in the place of I want the one before the other. Like, I don't want any flying car until self-driving cars are perfected. Like,
well,
I don't
Brian,
want
don't
to
go
believe.
Look outside in your driveway.
Yeah, what? No.
Wait, why is that? Why are you insisting on there being an order to it?
Mainly because it seems like the fact that the flying cars will be inherently noisier, and there's the safety issue of do we want to rely on human beings to pilot these things instead of, you know, computers that will adhere unerringly to sky lanes and set areas that won't disturb neighbors and so on. It's like, I want to see all that technology worked out on the ground, and then, let's open up the skies.
I would, Brian, I'd make the argument, I mean, one, these things are going to happen, whatever they're going to happen, but from, if you're looking at like the different stages and trying to do in car driving and that technology, it's a very different problem set. You know, cars are worried about bicyclists on the other side of bushes, and self-driving cars, as they say, work really, really well at like, you know, 50 miles above or like 10 miles or below. But there's that range where they don't, where the reaction times are slower. You know, it takes too long to react to the bicyclist popping out or whatever. Very, very different problem set than flying vehicles. Remember, we've had collision avoidance in airplanes far longer than we've had them in cars.
Right. Well, and I know also that a friend of mine who is a pilot, he was saying that, you know, given the fact that you have air lanes, you know, where different vehicles are going different directions and they're separated only by 1,000 feet, they like – company policy, and again, all this is hearsay, maybe the guy was pulling my leg, but he was saying that company policy is you have to provide justification for why you ever took the controls. Like it needs to be mm-hmm. autopilot running things, because we can't have one plane drifting 500 feet up and the other plane drifting 500 feet down and have a head-on collision in the sky.
Yeah, I think that we're going to, if we, in all the versions of these flying, electric flying vehicles we see, there's sort of the assumption is it's going to have its own, you know, automatics controlling it. You know, Ehing, which is the Chinese company, that if you've looked up theirs, they just got permission to test theirs in Nevada.
So that's, I guess, my question is really this flying car conversation to me is a little bit loaded because we've always had this idea about flying cars. Like, it means something historically that I think really piques people's interest. But the idea of a manned drone, right, is something mm-hmm. that we saw at CES. Seems fairly reasonable as drones become, you know, more of a part of our life. And we continue to sort of fight the our people, drone hobbyists and companies want to make it more and more legal for them to operate on a regular basis. So, like, this seems like we're in a weird place, because it's like flying car, awesome. There's a reason why we're talking about it, because to say we're going to talk about flying cars right now is just an awesome phrase. But, you know, how different is this? I mean, how is this not just the logical, like, next step for what we've seen?
Well, here's my question is how much time, and in a world where we have self-driving cars, for most people's commute, this is going to save you. Let's say your commute is 30 minutes long. It could cut it in half to 15 minutes. To me, once you've unlocked that 30 minutes of what was useless time and made it productive time, whether it's catching up on your emails, finishing your homework, or you know, making important business phone calls or whatever, this seems like the kind of thing that will be only for the super elite. Like it won't be twice the cost to get there in half the time. It'll be 10 times the cost to get there in half the time.
I don't know, because I think that, you know, we're seeing the convergence of rideshare, you know, technology with, you know, the idea of these autonomous flying vehicles. Because what happens when, like, I, you know, where I live in Burbank, certain times a day, it is very, very far away from, you know, downtown LA, right?
Right.
So certain times a day, it's not as much. And if you say, okay, what would 10,000 of these vehicles do to reducing congestion? A lot, do a tremendous amount to reduce that. Is it going to be first, like you point, the elites? Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Who are the first people to even use Uber?
Sure.
But after a period of time, the costs start to fall. And that depends on, you know, we have a lot more bandwidth for putting things through the air than we do on the ground.
Do you remember the first time you used Uber? Like, before it was even UberX or any of that? Before it was a guy doing it on part-time, back when it was just a black limousine service?
Just delivery cabs or whatever?
Yeah, dude. It felt like such an indulgence, but oh, hot damn, did I enjoy it. It felt so good getting around L.A. Like, you know, I don't know. I took Jason on something or other, and I was like, oh, you have to experience the Uber.
Yeah, I think that we're going to get kind of all of these things are going to start happening in different ways. And, you know, I certainly think I might take an Uber because, like, man, there's things I can get done on the way from here to there and I don't want to be driving. So I'll do an Uber. And this is a case where you might say, oh, yeah, you know what? I'll spend five times as much to get there taking this vehicle just so I can get there twice as fast.
Yeah, they're opening up. They're building new lanes in Mopac Loop 1 here in Austin, and they're going to be one of those variable rate lanes where it's like if you absolutely want to pay to bypass traffic, they're willing to take your money, which I got to tell you just seems like the most sensible thing on the planet to me now, even though 20 years ago I would have gone nuts at the idea, but I can't wait for it to get here because most times I won't be using it, but the thought that, you know, if there's ever an emergency, some kind of appointment that I have to make or whatever, it's like, yes, take all my money. Just tell me I'll get there on time.
Yeah. Speaking of on-time delivery and building a system in which you can rely on things getting from point A to point B, we had a interesting revelation from Elon Musk, who, by the way, as we've talked about, I think it's in September, they're supposed to be announcing their plans, their ambitious plans for what they want to do with Mars, including the Mars Colonial Transporter, which is going to be this massive rocket, bigger than we've ever seen, that they're actively going to start producing. And he can't, anytime he's in an interview and people ask him about that, you can tell that he's super excited to tell you what's going on, but he's just like, gotta wait, can't tell you. But he did let on a couple interesting details when talked, because of the fact that SpaceX announced that they're going to try in 2018, folks, which is not that far away, to launch a rocket to Mars load with the first Dragon, the new Dragon 2, the craft that will be capable of landing. And it'll have like 10 times the mass anybody's ever put on Mars. And Elon Musk says, yes, what we're going to do is we're going to shoot for 2018, and 26 months later, when Mars is in its next ideal position, we plan to send another one and another one and another one, and I want to create a reliable, basically, schedule of deliveries to Mars that will then scale up to...
This is a really smart play, because it is one route that they will keep doing everything the same every single time. Here's the window. We're going to send. If you have experiments, we'll throw experiments on there. You want to buy out the whole thing and take a ride? Take a ride. But basically, by specializing not just on one topic, which is getting stuff from Earth to Mars, but along only one specific route with complete regularity using the same equipment each time, I think that's a smart way to go.
Yeah, or and eventually expanding on it. But yeah, the idea of part of what made the computer have more power was the internet. Part of what made the internet more powerful was the idea of APIs and services, and the idea that I know I can go to Amazon and I can pay them X amount of dollars and they'll hold this stuff for me. I can build a business saying, as I get bigger, I just adjust this cost factor. FedEx was like, oh yeah, well, if we know there's this predictable rate at which we can send our products from point A to point B, or UPS, et cetera, or even going back to the mail system. You know, when mail routes were established and we said, hey, you know what, if you want to get something from, you know, Boston to New York City, here's a fixed rate that you can do that. You can now build a business because we're going to provide the service to do that. And so we've seen this wonderful mixture of government and private services that say, hey, we will provide this reliability. And now seeing that we're getting that with Mars is amazing, because now if you're a university, your researchers, whatever, and you're like, well, what's it cost? What can we do to get a payload?
Is this craft? How large is it?
This is the – remember they unveiled the Dragon 2?
Uh-huh.
Look up Dragon 2. You'll see an image of that, and you'll see how large it is. So it'll be this is a thing that you could probably fit one really cramped person inside of there, but they would be a miserable trip.
Right. So that's what I was getting at, is like, yes, this would be more mass than we've ever sent to Mars before, but it's still not enough mass to send any kind of manned mission by a long shot, right?
Well, that's what the whole MCT is for. That's the whole idea of coming up with a new architecture for a much larger rocket system. And that's what he's going to unveil in September, is how he wants to send people there.
You know, it seems like you could, if you're doing the same route over and over and over again, it seems like you would build a giant kind of city. It makes it sound too large, but basically, I don't know, a space house, right? Picture the size of, you know, this house, and with modules that you just, you know, pull out and replace or theoretically maybe refuel. But if you could create an orbit that it just had to keep circling, and that something could rendezvous with it, throw humans, refuel, repackage, get everything restocked, and then send it right back on its way, then really the hardest part is already done, insofar as that you set up the route.
What are you trying to build?
Well, so we tend to think in terms of going to a place, stopping, turning around, and then coming back or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're planning to do a single route over and over and over again, then let's say something the size of this house, is just, you know, you spend a lot of money to get it going fast enough, and it just slingshots back and forth, back and forth. You know, every so often, you just got to goose it a little bit. And then, so essentially, it's not accelerating or decelerating. It's just on this, you know, we'll say it's and imagine in this overly simplified explanation, it's basically like a comet going just to and from Earth to Mars over and over and over again. Like, at that point, it really changes the profile of what you need to do to get people on there. You will have to spend money to accelerate up to the same speed as it is and to refuel it and restock provisions and everything, but load people up, and then when they get to Mars or whatever, they jump off, and basically this thing just keeps it doing its circle thing.
Well, you hit the problem with that is that your biggest energy cost is how much you would have to accelerate to intercept it, because you're essentially at a Mars intercept velocity if you do that.
Right, but let's say all of the mass that you are doing amounts to, we'll say, 30% of the total mass. All the fuel, all the provisions or whatever is 30%. Everything else is shielding all of this, the physical space, amenities and stuff. It's basically a circular flying hotel. And then all
so
of a
you
sudden,
don't have to keep putting that into orbit.
Correct.
Gotcha.
And so that is just set on rails, keeps going its route. You get in, you stay 6 months in the space hotel. You hop off, you make sure to take everything with you. And then, when the space hotel flies back on its own because of momentum, then they take people up and they speed up, and the service crews clean everything up for the next group. And, you know, and there's an expensive flight to accelerate very quickly to get the next group in to the space hotel. But by and large, you're not taking the majority of the mass. You're just riding on the success of the last mission.
And meanwhile, you have a sassy bartender and
occasional, you know, space murders.
Here's where the physics gets way beyond me, is that both Earth and Mars are moving through space at different rates. And so you're going to have to, your space hotel, you're going to have to still have a lot of fuel to do
corrections.
Your corrections, your trajectory. I don't know.
This is why I'm very, you know, this thought just occurred to me, and I know I'm oversimplifying, but if there was a way through some fancy math works to keep, you know, let's say 70% of the mass, you know, spend the exorbitant cost to get it on that circular trajectory, and then everything else is just sort of, I don't know, correcting and reprovisioning.
I mean, there might be. I mean, there certainly could be something, the argument of what you don't have to keep putting out of low Earth orbit, you know, to do, you know, what you don't have to kick out of there, what you can reuse and what you can do with reusable trajectories too. I mean, that'll be interesting, you know, when we see what they unveil, and because, you know, he's got dozens, you know, hundreds of people working on this problem to come up with more people have been working on this problem with a realistic time frame than have ever been working on it before. You know, NASA's done a lot of great research on that, but it's always been, well, if we had this, we have this, we have this, where they started from the premise of, let's start with building a big, huge friggin' rocket. You know, how big does it need to be? Then what can we do with that?
Yeah.
And that's exciting. Is it, you know, we're in, you know, just a few months away from seeing a plan for a Mars, you know, the colonization of Mars. We are less than 2 years away from a launch window from the first mission to establish a Mars colony.
That's freaking amazing.
Well, and that's what I think. So let's get back to this announcement that he's going to make. Let's assume that the goals, the broad goals that we do know going into this, he achieves.
Can I just say, what if he takes the stage and he's like, listen, my therapist has me on much better medication now. I'm so sorry for all this crazy stuff I've been saying.
I mean, that would be a weird things afterward. Like a
real bummer.
Just deconstructing the mind of Elon Musk.
I had no idea it would go this far. My name's not even Elon.
Yeah.
Sorry, Justin. Sorry.
So let's say that this happens, right? Everything that he has laid out comes to fruition. Where does that rank on like the great announcement when it comes to space? Like, is that like, are we within months of getting our own generation's, you know, like Kennedy announcement about a man to the moon?
Yep.
So how long, what was the timeline? Because this is amazing. I just realized, both, all three hosts of this program, and I would say the majority of everybody listening right now has never heard a bat crazy prediction like Kennedy's come true in their lifetime. They haven't heard the predictions and certainly haven't seen them come true in their lifetime. What would it be like? How long did it take from the moment he announced, like, hey, we're going to go to the freaking moon, to us being there? Less than 10 years, right?
It was like 8 years, yeah.
I got to tell you, man, if Elon Musk says in 8 years we're going to have a manned mission to Mars, I'm just like, ha, adorable. Like, I don't believe it at all.
And also, like, it wasn't like a Project Apollo started from scratch. You know, it was already.
Yeah, sure. I mean, they already had momentum, and every 20 minutes you were hearing about a new thing or living being thrown to some section of space.
Yeah, I mean, the pulling this up there, NASA Deputy Administrator Hugh L. Dryden announced the Apollo program to industry representatives in 1960. So, Kennedy announced this program, again, to his credit for supporting it, but this was a program that existed prior to Kennedy. It's not like he just woke up in the middle of the night and woke up Jackie or Marilyn Monroe hey, let's go to the moon. It's like NASA's like, hey, let's do this, you know, and then.
But specifically, I would just love to know what it felt like to everyday Joes to hear those words. Like, did it sound like crazy talk at the time, or did it sound like, yeah, we could do anything? We've invented plastic and Tang. Therefore,
I think it was exciting because I think that it was, you know, a young president, youngish, who announced, you know, by the way, announced on my birthday, May 25th, you know, announcing to America and the world that we are going to go after the most ambitious target in space. The thing that's, I mean, to say, not just to have NASA say, we like to do this, we want to do this, to have our president say, this is a critical thing that we're going to do. Huge, absolutely huge.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's it's kind of weird to wrap your mind around it, right? That because mm-hmm. this would be, you know, I mean, so we'd already be putting the cargo line, as Elon called it, you know, would already be operating in what, it was 2025 or 22 that he said the first manned mission.
Oh, 2025. All right, 2025.
So, you know,
24, launch in 24, landing in like 2025, I think.
Wow. That's crazy. I mean,
and it's where NASA's talking about 2030s for a still yet undefined mission. And that's the problem is that we are all fans of NASA. NASA's done an incredible, amazing things, continues to do that. But also in many ways, arguably, it's become a jobs program. Much of the reason it exists is to keep people employed. And as the primary goal, and not to be project-based, which means that you employ people who are working on older technology and older stuff, and not under the threat of, hey, this thing is dumb, this thing doesn't work now, we need to refigure out everything we're going to do. NASA is a very conservative agency that can't, you know, and you had, you know, our current NASA minister, he's a neat guy, but when he called the Falcon 9 old tech,
you know?
And it's like, well, it's old tech. We're working on this new one. Well, SLS, you know, what they're is not is even old. They're like, yeah, all those NASA rockets could, you know, their primary stages could land back on the ground. You know, I think what Blue Origin's doing is amazing. You know, what SpaceX is doing is clearly amazing. And I think that it's sort of frustrating when there's this defensive response from NASA that, you know, well, we could have done that. We did that, you know.
When you hear through the grapevine that, you know, it's – there's – Like all government agencies, there is an element that protects their budget, right? And then there is an element that, you know, wants to push things forward. And you hear it repeatedly that there are people within NASA that would just love to take off-the-shelf rocket technology from SpaceX Blue Origin.
And that's what's going to be exciting about this is that SpaceX has been very dependent upon NASA, a lot of NASA's research, NASA's technology, NASA personnel. And this mission, the first Red Dragon mission, you know, they want to make – and NASA's looking for all the different ways in which they can be involved in it because they have a tremendous amount of expertise. And as that expands outwards, it's kind of like, hey, this is where we're going. Let's figure out how to make this work with – you know, NASA's one of the greatest government programs that ever existed, in my opinion. But it doesn't mean it's always doing the most awesome things it can do.
I'm just sad that we stopped dreaming.
Yeah. No, come on! You stole my petty barb. That's my catchphrase. Is like jabbing it in the eye of I will not rest until we stop dreaming becomes the PC guys aren't just going to walk in and solve this level. Yep.
Making it the new jet fuel camp melt steel beams as we stop dreaming.
Whatever we need to do in terms of embarrassing public quotes, I just want that to be like the most embarrassing public quote.
I'm going to tell you, somebody who may have said something similar along those lines did say something that I was really very, very happy to hear him say when Neil deGrasse Tyson was on Bill Maher and pointed out that scientific illiteracy isn't a single party problem.
Yeah, no, that's I think that was a really good point. I actually did not watch the video itself, but when you think of scientific illiteracy, you tend to think of people who deny evolution. Or global warming or whatever. But on the flip side, you also have people who deny the importance of everybody using vaccines and
genetically modified organisms.
Yeah. No, there's plenty of literacy on both sides of the political spectrum.
Yeah, I was really glad to hear Neil deGrasse Tyson point that out. I was really, really glad to hear him say, like, hey, yes, there's this group does this silliness. This group here, by the way, that takes the high road. And I was really impressed to hear him say that, you know, because it's not always a politically popular thing to point out, to say that, you know, Not every progressive is scientifically literate as they profess to be.
Yeah.
I have a lot of friends who love to put up F yeah science stuff on Facebook, and then they'll put, you know, anti-GMO nonsense, you know, and it's like,
Hey, man, you're staring so much at these constellation photos, sometimes you can't, you know, bother to find out whether or not GMO is a real thing or not.
Yeah, when Mercury's in retrograde, though, you just can't focus on a lot of
this Mercury in retrograde thing. It's just the most. Brian, does that happen to you a lot in Texas? Do people talk about Mercury in retrograde?
Wait a minute. I always thought, like to me, I assumed that what you're describing is the most cartoonish overrepresentation of what people who believe in astrology would say. But you're telling me that's a real thing?
Oh. It is a lifestyle.
Like, okay, that to me is the equivalent of somebody trying to express what cavemen are like by saying ooga booga and then slamming club on the ground or whatever.
Dude,
like,
number
I'm like,
one, I don't know when it's in retrograde. I know it seemingly is permanently in retrograde. It's literally like, oh, geez, you know, crazy stuff's happening. Well, Mercury's in retrograde, am I right? And then they high-five you and they move on. Like, it is among the craziest things that I have had to adjust to after moving to California.
Oh my God, this is amazing! Because to me, like that phrase conjures images of crazy crystal-toting psychos from the 1970s.
Welcome to California, Brian.
Yeah, I guess so. Wow.
Have you met our governor?
I know. So it's I still don't
hold on real quick. We're looking at a astrology horoscope chart, and for the life of me, that looks like somebody's holding up his Motorola Razr from 2007.
I mean, the easiest way to understand it, it's imagine Earth's orbit, imagine Mercury's orbit, and then we get to a period where Mercury kind of is going backwards in comparison,
or appears to go backwards from where we're standing. Yeah.
And that's why it's clearly science, guys. And why are you questioning this?
Plus, it has the word astro in there.
Mm-hmm. Great. Do you guys want to do picks?
I do. I have a pick I'm so passionate about. Mm. And I'm curious. I'm curious if Bryce even knows what it is. Do you have a guess?
I got an idea.
Is it Bryce's haircut?
It might be Bryce's haircut.
Because that's my pick.
Before we do this, here's what I want to say. One. Those of you who don't know, we do a show after Weird Things called After Things, where we talk about being a creative. We give you our input, and people are welcome to send in their businesses, things they're working on, and we'll give our applied genius to it, which is negligible. So if you want to send something to After Things for us to discuss, just send it to neshcom@gmail.com.
Yep.
And use After Things in the subject line, because listen, what Bryce is sorting through all sorts of fan mail, all sorts of things, marriage proposals, DJ opportunities. It's crazy. So put After Things in the subject line. And you could do that today. If you send one in right now, if you're watching this live or listening live, we could answer it. But if you want one to go in next week, do it now. Same thing.
Yeah, do it.
But here's what I say right now. I think we should do a pick I feel really good about my pick. I'm gonna say I'm gonna have the best pick, Brian.
I think I've got the better pick. I'm not gonna lie. I'm really excited about this pick.
All right, I swear, if you steal my pick. Let's see who's got the bigger pick.
Mine is a legendary reboot of a much beloved franchise, helmed by talented individuals who've proven their mettle time and time again. The showrunners for Netflix's reboot of Voltron, Legendary Defender, are Lauren Montgomery and Joaquin Dos Santos, who did Avatar The Last Airbender and The Legend of Korra. And I had read this story months ago on Cord Killers, and then just one day over the weekend noticed, oh, wait, it's out. And within 15 minutes, I was in love. They bring so much humor, so much joy. They have such a wonderful sense of what's too cheesy, and they inoculate against you rolling your eyes at it by injecting just the right amount of humor and self-awareness. It's postmodern in all the right ways. I am 2.5 episodes in with my daughter, and it's so great because Penny has watched Korra like 3 times. She's watched Avatar so many times I can't even count. And to see so many of the same archetypes, so many of the same clever character bits, but in a sci-fi universe with what little I remember from, you know, catching Voltron back in the day, it has been pure joy. I cannot recommend it highly enough. I'm having the best time.
Interesting pick, Brian. I wonder how I would try to top that, Brian.
I'll do mine real quick in the middle. So I've been on the road all weekend doing stuff for the Jury Patreon, live shows in Louisville, meet up in Cincinnati, and right after this, I'm actually probably going to have to bag out of after things so I can set up for the Chicago show. But I want to just plug patreon.com. Like, I know we did our own Patreon plug for this thing, but like, I think sometimes it can just sort of get blown by on some of these shows, and it's just like a cool way to kick money back. But like, for real, like, this was and is continuing to be kind of like a life and career changing experience this weekend, and it's all because Patreon is just amazing. You know, there's really no other way to put it other than life changing.
Oh wow! It's funny. Like, as it's going by, I'm seeing names of people who I know, and Grant Thompson, the King of Random, does fantastic stuff. And we've chatted about ways to monetize his channel. And I know I told him about Patreon, and I encouraged him to do it back in the day. And seeing that, man, it's just wonderful.
Patreon's gonna be that thing. 3 years from now, people are going to talk about it like they did Kickstarter. You know, when early on, you're like, "This is great," and then finally, everybody else catches on, like, "Hey, what's great?" And it's like, "Yeah." And if you're a creator, what's super cool is this. All right, you ready for mine? I'm going to put us on speakerphone, so it might get kind of crap.
Uh-oh. All right. Roger.
Hey, I'm back.
Oh, yeah. What's up?
Oh, yeah. You know, hey, listen. Just me and my hoodie. You know,
Nice black hoodie.
Yeah, it's a nice hoodie.
Yeah, you know, like, you know what?
Is that like North Face?
Sometimes I travel and like, I'm like, hey, it's kind of cold. You know what I could really use when I travel and it's cold?
Gloves.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe some gloves.
What?
Okay. So it's got like the thumb.
It's a hoodie that has built-in gloves that normally sit recessed on the inside.
Yeah. You're like, okay, hey, that's really cool. You know what? I like pocket space. So I could put my sunglasses here, my other stuff here. I put my hands in my pockets here. I've got a pocket I can kind of pull out and use to wipe stuff down. Now, I can open it up. I've got a pocket right here. Oh, it's got my little earbuds in case I want to make it quiet. I can put my phone in this pocket, and I can still use my phone through the plastic here, right?
Oh, that's sweet. So
you're
basically,
like, hey, that's really cool.
Yeah.
You're like, hey, what else can you do with it? Like, oh, I don't know. Let's see. Maybe if I'm traveling and I kind of, it's kind of like raining. Let me put a hood on. Okay, I've got a hood on. Okay.
Yeah.
But you know what? Maybe I want to go take a nap.
It doesn't sleep mask.
And it does. He's the emperor now. Can you say everything's gone as you've foreseen it?
Sometimes my head gets a little bit uncomfortable because, I don't know, I'm sitting on an airplane all day.
No.
And I just want to just tilt my head to the side.
It has a built-in.
Oh my god! It's got an inflatable tube on there.
Yeah, no. So I'm actually curious on whether or not I have this jacket or if this is a competitor.
So I've got this nice little comfy hilt headrest.
Wow.
All right. Let me just deflate that. I'll put that away for right now. But you know what else? Sometimes I go places and I don't know, man. It's like that wind. Like if I were in Chicago right now, which maybe it's summer, I don't know. But all I know is if I'm in Chicago and it's going to be windy, I just want to protect my face.
That's good. That's good, too, in case you wanted to rob a bank. You're ready to go.
I want to go to the airport, and I don't want people recognizing me, and I want to be anonymous. I just pull this face mask in front of there. And TSA is like, don't bother him. He just wants to chill out.
He's just a ninja.
Okay, so, you know, that's all kind of cool. Then I've got the normal drawstrings, but man, you know, what if I get kind of bored? Oh, I don't know. Let me just reach inside my pocket here, and I've got two of these pockets, and I can pull out. Oh, let's see what's in here. Oh, hey, look. What's this? Oh, it's my iPad.
What?
Stored inside of the pocket. So,
wait, is that your new crazy big iPad?
No, let's not be ridiculous.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm sorry.
So I got my iPad. Talk. I can store two iPads in here and my power cords, everything else in my earbuds.
Holy cow.
All in.
So who's this from? Is this a Scotty Vest joint?
XY37.
No, this is the this one is the XY37 or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. So I backed and received the Bow Bow Ultimate Travel Jacket that does a lot of this.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't read any reviews of what is better or different. I know that I've traveled with the one that I got that, and it is, man, life changing. It was so rad,
dude. Yeah, you left out my favorite feature that I just saw on there, which was an earplug pocket. Like, having earplugs on you means, like, instant sleep anywhere, always.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. There are a lot of features. Yeah, the Bow Bow has some – there's some mixed reviews on that. The Bow Bow, though, they have – some, and, like, I've heard, like, they've missed, you know, their shipping dates, but I think some people are getting – somebody on my Twitter said they got one. They love it. They have – what I love is they have a really cool-looking blazer, which when they have a reliable shipping that we know when we get that, I will probably order that.
Yeah, no, I got the Bomber, and it was pretty cool. It definitely is, you know, it took a little long to do. They also have a drink pocket, which I don't know exactly in practicality how – you know, how much I really want to use that. In fact, I think I might have already thrown it away.
So you have the Bowbacks, though?
I do, yeah.
Interesting.
I think the two of you guys clearly
have to fight each other now. I mean, there's only one way.
Well, we're going to see who can sleep fastest on an airplane and whose hands are more comfortable. And then we will truly decide who the king is. But yeah, no, I mean, number one, if you travel... like, and here we get into these, like, kind of very alienating and annoying conversations about, like, you know, comfortability when you're doing traveling for business. But, like, it is, especially if you're on red eyes, especially if, like, sleeping on planes is kind of a necessity for a schedule, like, oh, it makes all the difference in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just looked at how much I was just traveling and how much I had to carry with me, and I'm like, man... what's always in my backpack that I would like to carry elsewhere? And I looked into that.
Hold on. The phone's... I'm sorry, guys. I got to take this call. It's the President of the United States. He's... Oh, you agree? Yeah, sorry. The President thinks Voltron's cooler than your hoodie. He says it was close. He said it just barely was cooler.
Yeah, listen. My hoodie kind of makes me Voltron.
Ah!
Just saying.
But I get to sit there...
Hey, paper beats rock, bitch.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.